Well, on that note, good morning, everyone. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ,
blessed Master,
saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles,
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual
development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Swami Mangalananda's visit this last week, we've been filled with Anandamoyi Ma. So I thought I would read from Ma's writing about Ma by Swami Mangalananda. This is a tremendous realized woman. Master said it was the greatest woman saint that he had met in his time in India, which is saying quite something because he had met some of the really greats. And it is said that she is born into this life in a completely realized state. She never lost consciousness of who she was. And so we see here a time when she is not yet well known. She was married at the age of 12, as sometimes happens in older India. And she's there with her husband at Kirtan with Bolanath and also one devotee. At one point in Ma's wanderings in these northern regions, she was staying in a small cave near the hill station of Simla, with Baiji and one other devotee. It was here that Raj Durg Singh, a local Maharaj who was the ruler of Ceylon, heard of her. He was a great man of sterling and religious character, and always sought the company of saints and religious leaders. He came to visit Ma, finding her sitting in perfect poise and ease in the intense cold and dampness of the rugged hillside cave. Upon seeing her sweet and blissful countenance and hearing her inspired words, the Raj became an ardent devotee of Ma, frequently inviting Ma and the entire entourage that was traveling with her at the time to stay on the grounds of his palace. Ma gave him the name Yogi Bhai because of his deep practice of yoga meditation. First, Raj Durga Singh's family and later his entire court became Ma devotees. Later, all the people in his province became acquainted with Ma and became her admirers and followers. Ma always stressed that all spiritual attainment can be achieved by a sincere and sustained application of the repetition of the name of God. She said, "Always bear in mind that God's name is Himself. Let it be your inseparable companion. Since all names are His indeed, He will allow Himself to be grasped by any one of them." This was illustrated in her own life many times, both in her days of sadhana and afterwards. The most dramatic illustration was the divine bhav, the manifestation of dramatic interior states, that manifested during kirtan at different periods in Ma's life. In the following years, her departure from Shah Bagh Gardens in Bengal, there were no manifestations of this kind for an extended period. But once again in 1936, the devotees were privileged to witness this awesome and beautiful manifestation. In Simla, Ma was invited to attend the yearly observance of a local religious sect. In this festival, Everyone spent an unbroken 12 hours walking slowly around a beautifully decorated altar placed in the middle of a large hall, while melodiously chanting the holy names of God to the accompaniment of hand-played drums and cymbals. From the very commencement of the singing, a palpable spiritual atmosphere was produced, and Bolanath and Didi both noticed that Ma was affected and was beginning to enter a deep inner state. Bolanath, who is her husband, requested Ma to control this inner upsurgence, as he was not sure how strangers would respond to Ma's spontaneous manifestations during kirtan. When I read this, it reminded me of Mother Hamilton and her husband, Father, and how sometimes he would try to restrain Mother, and Mother sometimes would try to restrain herself, but ultimately God had his way. Ma had the kaol to keep within herself throughout the day as she sat and watched the people circumambulating the hall to the rhythm of the holy chant. Didi recounted that despite Ma's effort to keep contained the great spiritual current and force that was rising inside of her, it was reflected in her face and movements. At different points in the course of the day, a bright light would play across Ma's countenance, or her gaze would become fixed as she would be transported into a yogic samadhi. Finally, in the concluding climatic hour of the performance, Ma suddenly stood up and walked in the midst of the crowd of singers. Her movements were as swift and awesome as lightning. At times, she could be only seen as a blur of white. Her body was as weightless as a leaf blown by the wind. All her spontaneous gestures bore the grace and beauty of the divine power that the holy name was releasing within her. At times she would roll on the floor and then being drawn up on the tips of her toes, barely touching the floor, swaying to the rhythm of the singing. The people of Simla, well versed in the literature of their sect, and knew that these states from the scriptures. Now they were seeing the scriptures come alive before their eyes. The fervor of their singing increased 1,000 times. At the conclusion of the kirtan, Ma sank to the floor, while in a deeply absorbed state, divine mantras emanated from her mouth in a sweet and enchanting voice. The people knelt around her in reverence, some reciting hymns to the Devi. They made Ma promise that she would attend their celebration every year, and from then onward, her photo adorned the hall where the festival took place. Wherever Ma went, she encouraged women to sing kirtan also. By the standard of society, the performance of group public singing was done only by the men, and the women listening from a separate room. Ma suggested that the women should also take a turn in the festivities. Ma told the men not to leave their wives out of this important spiritual practice, but that they should support and help in their religious life. By Ma's inspiration, in many places she visited, the women began to gather in their own kirtan sessions, Ma walking and singing with them and encouraging them in their efforts. And this small booklet by Swami Kedarnath, Sri Sri Ma Anandamoy. This is something about Ma's life. Sri Ma's paternal grandmother had the intense desire for her son, Bipin Bihari, to bear her a grandson. Full of resolve, she went to the temple of the goddess Kali in a nearby village with the intention of petitioning the Devi for this desire. But upon seeing the divine form of Kali and falling into a spiritual mood, she found herself asking for a daughter instead of a son. After this incident, Ma took birth. Ma's mother followed the custom of daily offering prayers and worship to the holy tulsi plant, and for this reason, a raised platform with a large tulsi adorned the courtyard of their house. One evening, as Sri Mokshada Sundari was performing her prayers before this shrine, upon raising her eyes, instead of seeing the tulsi plant, she beheld the effulgent form of a beautiful divine goddess whose face radiated blessing and grace. With a smiling countenance, the vision blessed the astounded woman and then changed into the form of a great circular light, rotating and pulsating with power. This light then entered into the body of Sri Mokshara, who fell unconscious to the ground from the influx of power. Shortly after this, it was found that she was with child. After this light entered her womb, for the succeeding months, Mokshara Sundari had many visions, both in her sleep and during her waking hours. Various forms of gods and goddesses came to her, and she had the feeling that they were all living with her and taking their place within her and in her home. At birth, Ma never uttered a cry like a normal child, but rather possessed full consciousness and awareness. In later years, when asked why she didn't cry, she replied that immediately after her delivery, she was very happily gazing at the mango tree outside through a hole in the roof and felt no inclination to cry. Later, Ma recalled the name of all the people who came to visit her shortly after her birth, showing her perfect command of her senses and faculties from the beginning. From the early age of 2.5 years, Ma would enter into deep spiritual states and moods while listening to the singing of names of God in kirtan. After her 3rd year, she frequently had visions of divine personages passing in the sky before her inner gaze. During the same period, Ma would enter into deep mystical states in which she experienced the boundless infinitude of God beyond all names and forms. Here are some points that require reflection. Is it possible for a newborn child to observe a tree outside the house and recognize a mango tree? It seems a minor point, but shows that Ma had full control of all her faculties from birth. A normal child of 13 days would never be able to recognize and identify family members who visited and remember their names. Similarly, it is not a simple matter that a girl of 3 has the visions of heavenly beings. All these incidents related occurred before Ma reached the age of 4, showing that within this simple girl was a divine child. For these incidents, we can see that the greatness of Ma's spiritual stature was being foreshadowed, and it is clear that Ma's extraordinary powers accompanied her from the very moment of her birth. During the period that a normal child is simply learning to function through their basic senses, Ma was displaying spiritual states and attainments that even yogis and sadhus engaged in lifetime of austerity and penance are not able to grasp. This all occurred spontaneously and naturally with Ma. Her sight and vision was not of a child of this earth. Now the question arises, by what sight did she see these things that a normal child would never behold? We call this vision the sight of the observer, the sakshi, who can see and know without sense organs. Can this be the sight described in the Vedas as the witness of creation, whose sight is never absent? A devotee once asked Ma if she perceived life from the perception of the 2 physical eyes or from the 3rd spiritual eye. Ma replied, "Why do you ask if I see through any particular eye? This whole body is my eye. It is possible to see through any part of the body. Hands, feet, hair, all can be an organ of perception." In the history of spiritual world, who has spoken like this and given such wonderful and unique answers? Yesterday we had silence for a 6-hour meditation and a wonderful, wonderful time. And this is something that I had written earlier in the day and had ready yesterday. Silence is Sat Chit Ananda. Sat is your eternal nature without beginning or end. Sat is your knowing that you have always been, you are now, and you will always be. And that self does not change. Chid is the eternal witness. It is the consciousness of being aware. Chid is eternally realizing itself. And Ananda is the feeling nature and expressive nature of God. What bliss Ananda really is cannot be described, It is not like anything else. It is the pure joy of the presence of God. It is also eternal, and yet there is the play of it being constantly discovered anew. It is changeless, yet it is always revealing itself in constant variety. Within the silence of your being, all of this is, and you are that. The attainment of these exalted states is what is said to be the true goal of life. And yet, all of us come into this life usually in a way different than Ma's. Ma came into this life in that realized state. When she met Master, she proclaimed that before I was born, I was. Then I was born, I was. And still the person you see before me now, I am. She has always realized that sat experience, that eternal sense of being. Most of us identify with this body. And as a result, we get enculturated into the world around us and into believing that we are separate beings, apart from the universal nature of this sat being, the eternal self. And this is where all the problem begins, because at one point we had that realization. We knew this sat nature. And unconsciously, instinctively, intuitively, we still know it. We still yearn for it. And we will never be completely satisfied or fulfilled until we have realized it in its fullest nature. All the great masters have come to point the way. Each one manifests a personality that is very unique to itself. What they all have in common is this wonderful divine vision. And through that divine vision, a universal message comes out that there is just one deep spiritual experience that is common to all mankind and to all religions. This is an extract from Two Go Together, a recent autobiography by Japanese poet and writer Adele Marie Okamoto. That night, as I lay in the darkness of my room, meditating on what I had done and what the sage had told me, the darkness became suffused with light. And whether this happened early or late, I have no idea, nor how it happened. It simply was. And in the light, there was nothing I could see or sense except the light and a sort of consciousness, both of which had a sparkling quality, as if it were, so to speak, of a single substance, a substance that was clear and also coherent, as if this substance, this light, and this consciousness were truth itself, freed from the necessity of any words or any agency whatsoever. In this light and consciousness, I did feel a friendliness, a well-being, a complete absence of fear, as if in them there were present something of everyone and everything I've ever loved and admired and respected. And gradually, out of the diffuseness of this feeling, there rolled the globe of a concept that was like the birth of a star. The rolling, cumulative evolution of this star, as nearly as it can be translated into words, went something like this. The story of creation is the story of every man. The stories of Krishna, Buddha, Christ, Muhammad, of Judas, John, and Herod, and Satan, and of God the Father, these are but your story, the story of every man. You yourself are Alpha and Omega. You are Avatar. You are Manu. You are chaos in all forms. You are corruption at the bottom of the pond and also the lotus on the surface. Nor could one be and the other not be. So both and all are equal in honor. Truly, God is everywhere. Your spirit and his spirit and the spirit of the rock and of the tree and of the bird are forever one. Isn't that a beautiful, beautiful description? And no matter where we go, the world over, we can read of such experiences. From the ancient saints to modern ones. From religions that have their beginnings in some depthless well of time, to things that are being revealed even today. There's a constant upwelling of spirit. And it is because of man's dullness to spiritual sensitivities that he does not realize that this is the most tremendous creation you could possibly imagine. We see but the surface of this creation. We look out through these two eyes, and we see many times beauty, great beauty. Sometimes we see ugliness. Sometimes we see things that thrill us and uplift us into new realms and make us aware of new worlds, so to speak. And at other times, we can be so enshrouded by darkness and depression that we don't see out at all. We have no life energy in which we are able to apprehend what a tremendous place we live in. It is this: we live in a dark cave. And these are all states that exist within us. And it is true that whatever the greatest of sages, the greatest of saints, the greatest of spiritual masters have realized, we have within ourselves as well. You have that. Now, whether you are conscious of it or not is the only question. But you have it. It already exists within you. It is the eternal gift. And no matter what we do, no matter how many dark streets we go down, no matter how many mistakes, no matter how many evil actions we may perpetrate, we cannot destroy that light. We cannot alter it even. For the light exists beyond all darkness. It exists beyond everything that we are able to try to apprehend through this material mind. But this material mind is a very poor interpreter of events indeed. You can say it's the best that we have many times, so we do the best with what we have. But there exists beyond the reasoning material mind a mind that is so spotless, so pure, so tremendous in its apprehension of truth, light, and beauty that you could scarce believe it. It is what all the scriptures refer to. And it is true, very true, what this author has said here is that these scriptures are the story of every man in its ascent from the human to the divine. And so it is our story. It is your story. And isn't that a wonderful, wonderful thing? We can manifest this if we truly wish to. Master, from chapter 3, stanza 2 of the Bhagavad Gita, translates literally here, Prajapati, the creator of praji, or beings, said, "With this fire offering, meditate on the devas, the shining angels, and may the astral angels think of thee, thus communing with one another, thou shalt receive the supreme good." This is Krishna speaking. Master continues, "A literal interpretation of this stanza means that through fire oblations and chants, one should invoke the astral beings superior to man in the order of evolution who carry on the cosmic functions. Thus, man will create good karma, which will free his life from the hazards of sudden fruition of effects from unseen evil causes set in motion by him in the past." Materially minded people live their days in a wooden stupor by the sweat of their brows, like the mule which carries a huge bag of gold. This treasure is not only of no use to him through his complete ignorance, but is the cause of his active suffering through its weight. Worldly men, like the dumb animal, carry the heavy burden of material duties, suffering and fearing, but reaping little benefit from the onerous labors they perform. They only eat, sleep, earn, and procreate, giving not a single thought to the spiritual government underlying human life. When misfortune visits such men, they call it ill luck or accident. When good fortune arrives, they call it luck or chance. Few realize their lives are governed by the effects of past actions, or karma, and that they are subject to universal laws administered by higher beings. The Gita therefore points out that instead of leading an ignorant life, one should perform certain spiritual ceremonies ordained by saints to place oneself in harmony with high astral beings, thus bringing about a conscious control of life's happenings. The following of certain astrological injunctions, based on the mathematical or orderly nature of the unified cosmos, when such advice is received from self-realized sages, and not from superficial professional caster of horoscopes, can help to invoke the blessings of astral beings. This salutary result comes about through the righteous observance of astral or unseen laws which govern the universal structure. Contact with advanced astral beings elevates man, who may thus avoid the fructification of evil karma. Misfortune can thus be greatly lessened when the liberating effects of good actions are enhanced. Man and his astral preceptors in higher realms, by mutual communion, can find great good and control destiny, eventually by constant contact with spiritual forces. The soul of man comes into harmony with the Supreme Creator, organizer of all higher and lower beings. The worldly man, unable, consciously, to commune with astral beings, gains the same result by associating with earthly angels, true God-knowing saints, and by following their counsel. Now, for a deeper interpretation of this stanza can only be understood by advanced yogis. It follows, withdraw the life force from the muscle, efferent and afferent nerves, heart and other centers, and unite it with the subtle nerve currents in the spine, the coccyx, sacral, lumbar, dorsal, and cervical regions, where dwell respectively the five astral angels, Ganesh, God of success, the goddess of power, the creator, the god of fire, Vishnu, god of preservation, Shiva, god of dissolution. These five spinal deities sustain the human body and are diverse manifestations of one spirit. The yogi should let the life current automatically flow from the lower spinal centers to the higher ones by mental pushes of concentration. He should never be unduly attracted by the beauty of one center, for thus he will remain locked there, unable to proceed to the medulla and the cranial or the higher center. The five spinal deities are called the temporary form of spirit, as in time they are dissolved in the higher centers. After the yogi can direct his life force to the throne of light occupied by each of the five temporary deities, he learns to withdraw the current and unite it to the medullary center and the Christ center at the point between the two eyebrows. The single or spiritual eye where the changeless spirit dwells on the thousand-rayed throne in the cranium, the principal seat of individualized spirit or soul. This is a wonderful, wonderful teaching because it shows here how what we ordinarily apply to the outer realms, even the outer astral realms, the realms of light, of energy, that are subtle beyond this material realm, that all of this exists right within you, right within your own spine, and that there is a deity that is assigned to each one of the spinal centers. There is a spiritual vibration, there's a consciousness that goes with each one of these centers, and there's a positive and negative charge on each one of the center. As you learn to withdraw the life force and draw it up through the spine to the highest center at the medulla, and the ajna, the Christ center, as Master describes it here, you really enter into the sacred precincts, a sacred temple right within your own being. This is wonderful because no matter where you are, no matter what you are doing, you can enter into that interior temple, a temple of silence, a temple of pure state of being, of the Sat Chit Ananda. And it is through that withdrawal of the life force. But you see, there are oppositional forces. As I said, every one of these centers have a positive and negative charge to them. And so as we seek to withdraw the life force from each one of the center, which represents a different stage of consciousness, we have to go through all the positive and negative attractions and repulsions that are centered in each place. As we rise up high, we go to another center, and it brings with it its own positive and negative charges. Now, at the beginning, at the very base of the spine, is where we are rooted in our feeling that this body is my life. It is in this life that I was born, in this body that I was born, and it is in this body that I am created. And I don't see anything beyond the very basest, most material form. I have here a transcript that is quite fun. That's Mother talking about Ananda Moima. I've told some of you before the story of a young man who went before the great saint Ananda Moima, whom I have had the great privilege of seeing quite a few times and enjoyed tremendously. She was a just beautiful, filled with God, filled with love. So he came before her, and she was discoursing on God. And he said, "But Ma, I must tell you that I do not go along with what you say. I do not believe in God. I am an atheist." And she looked at him, and with her ever blissful smile, and she said to him, "Ah, my son, I see that God is very much present with you in the guise of his absence." Isn't that wonderful that God is very much present with you in the guise of his absence? And so we can deny God, but God, of course, can never deny us. And so in this base chakra, we have this very earthy, rooted sense in the body. And then we move up through the chakras, and we move into the creative chakra. And this is where children are created. And it's very strongly associated with the sex impulse. And so we search for bliss, really, that exists deep within the soul, but we see it and we try to find it through the senses. And eventually, as we go through many, many lifetimes of searching it out through the senses, we find that it has a relative value. It gives us a short amount of pleasure, but oftentimes followed by long-term difficulties. And so we see that it has limited value, and it cannot really hold all of our heart's desires. And then we move to the third chakra, and we see there the place of individual will. And we learn to have some control in this world. We learn to be able to manifest some things. And we create things, and we're able to have an influence in this world, and that holds sway with us for some time. Because we enjoy that. It's gratifying to the ego. Look at what I can do. Look at what I have done. I love the story that I've told you before of the young boy, and next to the church he decided to plant a garden. And so he worked very hard at it. He went out every day, he was hoeing. He was preparing the ground. He sowed the seeds. He would go out and water it and weed it every day. And he was very, very proud of this garden. And one day, the minister came out, just as the garden was coming into fruition and all the flowers and all the fruit were coming up. And the minister said, "My, what a good job you and God have done with this garden." And the boy was a little affronted. He wasn't sure that he wanted to share any of the credit, you see. So he said, "Well, you should have saw it when just God had this garden. It didn't look like anything like this." So in that third chakra in the will, we feel like this is I. I have done this. I can do this. I can have this influence in the world. I can think these great thoughts and so on. And it's all centered around the individuality. And then you move to the heart center above that. And for the first time, you go beyond the I, the individualized I that's just rooted strictly in the body. Now, this is the place where love awakens. You are, if you are in a state of infatuation or love that can come from here, depending on the degree that you are feeling it and the greatness of spiritual vibration, because once again, it has a positive and a negative charge. But you feel you could sacrifice yourself for another. You love them so much. And so you are now transcending the personal I-ness, and this is the place of the first mystical crucifixion. As we marked last week, the anniversary of the Easter celebration, we see that within every one of us, that we are made in the form of the cross, that if you stand with your feet together and your arms outstretched, that this is, you are now in the form of the cross. And it is here, at the heart center, the mystical crucifixion first begins. And you're climbing up this stairway within the spine. You are climbing up one step at a time. And as you go through this mystical crucifixion, you draw all the life force up to the spinal center. And when you have resolved it, you've really resolved it. You've gone beyond the body, and now you are in the astral. And you enter into the fifth center. And this is in the throat center. And this is the place of speech. This is the place of truth. This is the place of discernment. And you begin to understand the higher spiritual truths. Not because somebody has taught them to you, not because you have read them in a book, because you know them. You're going through that experience, and the revelations are coming to you. But even this you must transcend, because this is limited. You are still encapsulated in a self, in an I, of a limited nature. And now you go to the sixth center, and this is the Christ center. This is the third center, and this is the realm of the causal, the realm of the mental. And this is the subtlest realm. And this is where the idea of separation holds sway with you. It's just an idea, but it's a very powerful idea. And it's not one that easily gives its ground to you. And so you surrender yourself at each stage, but here the surrender must go the deepest, must be the most profound, in order to go completely all the way and release yourself from these three bodies, the physical, the astral, and the causal, or the idea body. And now you are released completely into the Sahasrara, the top of the body, at the very top of the head. And this is the complete and full release into spiritual consciousness. You are now no longer bound by any limiting ideas. You have complete and total freedom within spiritual consciousness. You can choose to leave the body completely, or you can choose to continue to serve in the body, and yet carry this oneness with this divine spiritual consciousness with you at all times and all places. Now there is no more a going in or out. This is the sahaja state, or natural state. No matter where you are or what you are doing, you are in that knowing oneness with divine consciousness. This is the sam kun lad of coming into this earth. This is the pinnacle. It is the absolute highest experience that you can enter into. You go beyond all the things that you see out through the five senses. You go beyond the astral and the causal. You have that direct union and complete and total consciousness with God. Now, to some, it may seem like a distant, long journey. But we can only begin right where we're at. And if we begin by chanting the name of God, by singing to God, by loving God, by learning to serve God in everything that we do, in all that we are, we turn ourselves completely and totally over to the divine consciousness. We don't let ourselves become dissuaded to the left or to the right above or below, we keep our eyes steady and straight toward the goal. This is the one commonality that all the great saints and all the great masters have. It's their absolute focus on attaining to the goal and not allowing themselves to be taken away from it. Now, this is no small thing, so we must prepare. We must prepare ourselves. And while we take it seriously, and we know that we must prepare, and we know that we must be engaged in this with 100% of our being, we should also feel that the divine consciousness is already within us. It is awakening itself within us. If it were not awakening itself within you, you would not have any interest in this whatsoever. One of the great sayings of Ma was she said that you cannot think of me if I did not think of you first. And she is not speaking as an individual consciousness. She is speaking as the universal consciousness. And if God were not thinking of you first, you would not think of God. The fact that you are interested at all in a divine awakening means that God has his thoughts boring down upon you, that he's awakening that love within you. Now, many people have grown up with negative associations with the name of God. But God is the most beautiful, lovely name in the English language. And because some have distorted it, some have changed it, some have tried to bend it to their own use, does not mean that the divine vibration that comes from this most magnificent word and concept has changed at all, even as you cannot change that pure pearl that is within you, that is that God awareness that has always existed in you. You can pile dirt upon it. You can throw stones at it. You can try to break it. You can try to destroy it. But you cannot. No one can. No one can. And so you should feel deep within your soul that this is the greatest privilege that you have, is to seek out this divine consciousness. You should feel that God has first thought on you. And therefore, you have the power and the attraction to think on God. Let us not waste our days and our nights. Let us focus our attention upon that divine consciousness. You do not have the power solely within yourself to awaken that divine consciousness. This comes through grace. But grace requires that you give your all, that you open yourself. You see, long, long ago, we closed the door to divine consciousness. We did it. As an individual ego consciousness, we chose to shut that door. And with all the power and all the might that we shut that door with, we have to exert just that much more power and that much more might in order to open it once again. You have to give your all. You have to surrender yourself 100%. It cannot be 50%. It cannot be 75%. We're always trying to make a deal, aren't we? Master was so lovely, of course, coming from India. He was trained in the early days of how to bargain. And so when he was here in America, he was always on the lookout for a bargain. And when he would give gifts at Christmas time and other times, he always loved to regale people with how he got it at such a bargain and how he found it at such and such a place, and he bargained them down to a certain price. Such a lovely, childlike, innocent soul. Such a great divine master that we have. I one time thought about our guru lineage, and I thought about what an extraordinary thing it is to be just within the thoughts and within the blessings of these great spiritual masters. Now, all masters speak of the same truth. They all speak of the same divine consciousness. Therefore, all the great spiritual masters are one. And there is no difference. It's only in our minds that there are differences at all. But we take on a certain love. And this is certainly true in my case. There have been times when different saints and different masters have taken on a living presence in my life. And I thought of it that they've been introducing themselves to me. Just down here at Lincoln Park, there's this wonderful way that we call Lari Mahasya Way. There's a beautiful, beautiful tree, broad, open, underneath. And as we were walking there, we felt so keenly the presence of Lari Mahasya, as more keenly than a physical presence even. And what love and what joy this great master manifests. And you see, all the great masters, they love the same thing that we do. They love the light. They love the bliss. They love the presence. And they loved it so much that they became so imbued with it that they became one with that. They became one with that until there could be no distinction left between I and spirit, I and this experience of light and love and joy. That the mind merged into the divine mind, and the human heart blossomed with divine love in such a way that now there could be no distinguishment between I in the little sense and I in the great sense. There's only one, only one. From Masters Paramahansa Yogananda's poem that he wrote, one that's everywhere. The wind plays, the tree sighs, the sun smiles, the river moves. Feigning dread, the sky is blushing red. At the sun god's gentle tread, the earth changes robes of black and starlit night for dazzling golden light. Dame nature loves herself to ray in changing seasons' colors gay. The murmuring brook e'er tries to tell in lisping sounds so well of the hidden thought by inner spirit brought. The birds aspire to sing of things unknown that swell within. But man first speaks in the language true, both loud and clear with meaning new, of that all else before has failed to full declare, the one that's everywhere. So perhaps in the springtime, most of all, we see beauties in nature. We hear the birds sing. We see the flowers begin to unfold their petals one at a time. And each one is a message to us, a message from the divine creator. This is your soul opening one petal at a time, receiving the light, opening to beauties and color new, and ever spreading yourself as revelation after revelation of divine consciousness lifts you higher and higher and higher until you dissolve in that light and you become forever one, forever one. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. to you all. Bow to the light within you.